Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Wednesday, August 5th. I'm Ray Graff. In late spring, the Trump administration appointed Harvard astronomer Avi Loeb to lead a new science advisory council tasked with finding the origin of UAP, or UFOs, spotted by military pilots and others. Our guest today has been named to that panel. Dr. Kevin Knuth is a professor of physics at the University at Albany. He is a former NASA research scientist and has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications. We will talk to Kevin Knuth, find the latest on UAP research. Take your calls this hour, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org. Professor Kevin Knuth, UFOs, your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us today is Professor Kevin Knuth. Kevin is a professor of physics at UAlbany and the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. He's a former NASA research scientist, having worked at NASA's Ames Research Center in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. His current research interests include the foundations of physics, quantum information, autonomous robotics, the search for and characterization of extrasolar planets, and unidentified aerial phenomena, which we'll talk about today. Dr. Knuth has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to give over 100 presentations in 18 countries. It can be seen on Netflix Encounters and in National Geographic's UFOs Investigating the Unknown, and probably many more since the last time he was on this show. If you want to talk UAP, UFO, whatever you want to call it, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. As we roll along, Kevin Knuth, how are you? How's the summer been?
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
This has been quite an interesting 3 or 4 months. Tell us about this panel that Avi Loeb is now heading.
Right. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence established the UAP Science Advisory Council, and it's headed by Avi Loeb out of Harvard University, and I was appointed to the panel, and this has been very interesting. So our job is to provide scientific advisors to people who in the government. So this would be to ODNI, to FBI, CIA, the president on UAP.
Doesn't it surprise you that suddenly not only are those in power interested, they've appointed a panel to give them advice and information? Does it, you know, you and I have been following this a long time. It seems like quite a change of direction.
It is surprising. And one of the things that is surprising about it is we need data from the U.S. government to do this advising. The data that we're to be working with is to be unclassified, so it's not, we're not working with classified data. We don't have clearance, and we have so far been in a position where we can request data. And in fact, when we started, we had a list of 50 cases that we wanted to be declassified and provided to us, and ODNI came back and said, well, yeah, we can't really do that.
Okay, so you put your finger on something. And our guest today is Dr. Kevin Knuth. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to talk UFOs with us. You put your thumb on something there. Very interesting. Even, you know, there's a professed interest in disclosure now. That's sort of the buzzword.
And right.
There's a fictional film about it, and it's all over everyone's lips. But we see congressmen like Congressman Burchett. He's asking for information and, to some extent, getting stonewalled. How can you, if your panel is asking for information and can't get any, what's the point?
That's a good question. And that's a question that we've asked in several of our meetings. how are we to act as an advisory council if we don't have any data on which to base that advice? And so at this point, we are now, we were told to focus on five cases, and we focused on five cases we requested from ODNI, and they're working very hard to collect that for us and declassify it and collect the data.
Can you tell us what the five cases are, briefly?
I don't remember what one of them was. One that Representative Luna had requested. I don't remember which one it was. And the one I was interested in having released was the Varginha, Brazil case. That case happened when it was back in the 90s, like 1996. There was a purported UFO crash in Brazil near the town of Varginha. And there was that evening, there was sightings of what people described as three aliens basically running loose through the town. You know, they were injured, and people encountered them. And in fact, one of the more famous stories is there were three girls coming home from school, and they found one of the aliens like cowering, you know, in trying to get some shelter. And the girls wanted to help it and went home and told their mom and all of this. So what eventually happened is they, according to the reports, the Brazilian military came in and they rounded them up and got them medical attention. And these things are always handled in very weird ways. So it was a neurologist. They grabbed – it's like it's done at random. Here's a neurologist. We'll have the neurologist look at them and tend to their wounds. Well, neurologists don't do that in their career. So and the neurologist has come forward and said, yeah, that's true. I took care of three aliens when that happened. And then eventually they died apparently, and their bodies were shipped to the United States. So a plane – an Air Force plane came from the United States, came down to Brazil and picked up the bodies. The pilot of that plane said, yes, that all happened. And the former Brazilian defense minister, who was defense minister at the time, has also publicly said, yeah, this is all true. This all happened. And what interested me about the case was that, from what I understood, the case mainly involved the U.S. having their bodies. Now, biology isn't a national security issue. You can't classify biology. So the bodies can't be classified legally.
Really?
And so we thought, well, look, if they just have the bodies, maybe we can actually get the U.S. to disclose something about the biology of the bodies, which answers the big question, are we alone, which is what we really are aiming for.
Right.
And the former Brazilian defense minister had then publicly stated, well, if the U.S. releases their data, we'll release ours. And I said, oh, yeah, this is the case to work on. we got two countries going to release data. That would be excellent.
But,
so,
I mean, you're not a biologist.
No.
The other aspects of this case, what science can you glean from this now 30 years later?
In other words,
if you had a body, biologists could take a look and drill down on that.
Right.
But you, as a physicist, what can you learn from this case now that took place in the 90s?
Oh, as a physicist, I'm not sure what I could learn. I mean, I would find the fact that if there were actual non-humans involved, they think that tells us a lot about what's going on.
You know, it's funny. My summer beach read shows you how exciting my life is. My summer beach read was Trinity. Jacques Vallée and Paula Harris wrote the book.
Right.
And he quotes you, one of your papers in there. And basically what you said was, hey, even if we get exotic hardware that nobody can figure out what it is, that's not proof that this comes from outside the Earth.
No, that's true. Right. Now, if we had biology, you might be able to find some proof that it comes from outside of Earth. Because if they don't have cells, if their biology is not cell based, right? Or if they aren't, or if it isn't based on DNA or has exotic chemistry, that would be very interesting.
Well, how convinced on a 1 to 10 scale is Professor Kevin Knuth that some of these sightings, and not necessarily what's been released by the U.S. government in the four batches that they've released? We'll talk about that in a minute. But 1 to 10, Are any of these sightings over the last 80 years really strong cases that something from not this human reality is involved?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that there are a number of cases at this point that make it pretty clear that we're not dealing with human technology. So this is non-human tech. Who these non-humans are, we don't know. Are they from Earth? Are they from another planet? That we can't answer. But you can see this when you look at the energy and power that's involved in some of their maneuvers, and unless
there's no mass involved, right?
But that gets tricky, right? Things have mass. So, and some of these craft are known to have mass. In some cases, they've landed and left landing imprints and things like this. The one case I find interesting is a underwater case. It's an underwater USO from New Zealand in 1986. There was a New Zealand frigate, the HMNZS Southland, was conducting experiments trying to lure in USOs to study them. And they had, during one of these events, the experiments ran from, I think, November of 1986 to about February of 87. And it was in February of 87, they would leave Auckland, go up through the Hauraki Gulf into the Pacific Ocean, about 100 miles out in the Pacific Ocean, then turn around and come back, and they would just watch on passive sonar to see if they're followed. And on one occasion, they were followed by a large object without propeller wash. So they couldn't identify what kind of submarine it was or who it belonged to. And the object beamed about 150 feet wide.
What do you mean beamed?
Well, beamed with the sonar beam. So they measured it. They measured its diameter of the cross section of the hull of this thing was about 150 feet. And they wanted a length, so they made some sharp turns so they could see it from the side. And they measured its length to be about 800 feet.
That's big.
Which is big. The largest submarines are the Soviet Typhoon class submarines, about 600 feet long. So this thing's 30% longer than the biggest submarine. And it was about 2.5 kilometers behind them and followed them into the Gulf, which worried them because usually when they were followed in, that were the USOs, they would get to the Gulf of Hauraki, the Hauraki Gulf, and they would then turn around and go back into the Pacific Ocean. And this thing didn't turn back. And the captain was a little worried about this. So they sped up the ship to try to get away from it. And so they're doing their top speed, something like 45 knots. And the object suddenly sped up and closed that 2.5 kilometer distance in about 25 seconds and went under the ship. And when it went under the ship, it actually drained all the power from the ship, drained their batteries. So they were adrift. They couldn't even use the radio for calling for help. They were adrift for about 4 hours before they were able to flag down a fishing boat to call for help for them. But the amazing thing is there's no wave. You know, this thing went under the ship without any waves or anything. So you've got to think about this. You've got a 150-foot diameter cylinder cruising through the water. The top speed you can estimate is something like 3,000 miles an hour. And because it's got to close that 2.5 kilometers in 25 seconds, it's got to push. That thing's got to push 2.5 kilometer cylinder of water out of the way. Now, water's not compressible. So water has to go up. So you have got to lift that up. And so there should have been a huge wave above this thing, which wasn't present. And at moving at those speeds in the water, it's almost as if it's not interacting with the water.
Well, again, doesn't this point to somehow it not having any mass?
Well, it's not clear how you cannot have mass. So, I mean, the thing is, the thing's underwater, right? So you can assume at least it has to have the equal mass of the water at least, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, okay, let's take a quick break here.
So it's a crazy case, but the amount of energy involved, it's like, hundreds of megawatts of power to be able to pull something like that off.
Professor Kevin Knuth is our guest today from UAlbany. He is a part of the UAP Science Advisory Council led by Avi Loeb, and we're going to get into it a little deeper. You want to call? Call 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Professor Kevin Knuth today from UAlbany. Kevin is a part of the UAP Science Advisory Council, which was named earlier this, late spring, I guess it was. And you guys have met regularly?
We've met pretty regularly, yep.
What do you talk about?
Well, we talk about cases that we'd like to see. We talk about what... the committee was formed by ODNI, the Director of National
right.
Intelligence. So we have been talking to one of the people from ODNI to see what kind of data we can get. We've been going over the tranches of UFO data that's been released so far, trying to see if there's anything useful there. There's not much useful there.
I've gone
at all.
Through. You know, when I was looking at this, the fourth batch of government videos and documents, which I think is the best one yet.
The fourth one's is the most interesting, yeah.
But it's still all of the data, the speed and the wind speed and the direction and the altitude, all of that's blacked out.
Redacted, yep.
It reminds me of the UAPX website, which says data without context is dangerous. And it's a great way to look at it. You can't get anything out of those.
You can't get anything out of it. Yeah, if you don't know how big an object is or its distance or your distance to the object, you can't actually calculate speeds.
So let me ask you a question. And you're not part of the release of these things, but in your opinion, why release it if it only leads to more questions? It's not disclosure.
I think the first releases especially were an attempt to, let's just appease these folks and maybe they'll take these pictures and go away and make it all stop. And I think that was what was going on. Now, this last data set was a little more interesting. For me, I thought the two, being former NASA and part of the NASA family, I thought that the two NASA photos were quite interesting because, you know, so there's the one from Apollo 17 with the three lights in the sky.
The blue lights or whatever.
That's pretty strange.
Yep.
And what it made clear and what I've been grappling with is the fact that NASA has apparently had images of unknown objects in space and has kept that secret on purpose. And I find that really difficult. I was very proud of my time at NASA and have great respect for NASA scientists, but you don't cover up data. I mean, that's not something a scientist does. So I have a hard time with this.
So this is the cover up was done at the bureaucratic level then? It was not at the scientific level.
It's not clear where the cover up's happening. They apparently have photographs of objects in space or on the moon that they don't know what they are. And Congress asked them last year to provide a report on what they know about these things. No mention of any of those reports. No mention of objects seen by astronauts. I was fortunate to be able to talk to astronaut Alan Bean, who was on Apollo 12.
Yeah.
And he was telling me about how when they were in Skylab, they saw a red flashing light. A red flashing light off in the distance actually approached Skylab and then left. And they took photographs of this. And why was that information never put in the report to Congress? Now, cosmonauts have seen things, too, in space.
Yeah, including some strange things like giant angels and
all sorts of weird stuff.
Yeah.
But this should be reported. I mean, if Congress wants to know what NASA knows about unknown objects, that should be talked about.
All right, so let me ask you a question. You guys are all brilliant, well-credentialed scientists on this panel. Do you think they already know? One of the criticisms of Project Blue Book for years was, this is just a PR exercise. Hynek did his best after the late 60s, but they really were just used to keep people not that interested. I mean, could this be what you're there for?
That's something we discuss when we meet, actually.
Yeah.
We all talk about this and worry about this when we meet because none of us want this to be the case. We also talk about what the UFO people say. A lot of them are thinking, oh, this is part of the big conspiracy continuing. These guys are being told what to say and told what to, which is not true at
right.
all. We are all there sincere. Everyone on that panel is sincerely trying to figure out the truth. And I know for a fact that some of us, if we find out that this panel is somehow, as you say, just put there as a, you know, as a distraction or to just appease people, if we find out that's the case and we're not really doing anything, several of us are going to walk.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Professor Kevin Knuth from UAlbany joins us today. It's UFOs and UAP. You can email voxpop@wamc.org. John wrote in, oh, come on, let's please talk about why these huge data dumps have coincided so well with all the BS from the administration and they're trying to avoid talking about. That's from John.
Well, I wouldn't call it a data dump because there's not much data there.
That's the
It's
thing.
More of a garbage dump. And, yeah, of course they coincide.
You know,
they're not releasing anything useful. It's all distraction. You're right.
Our number here again is 800-348-2551. Let's jump to the phones very quickly here. And Paul is in Kingston. Paul, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, hello, Paul.
Okay. I believe in phenomenon. I believe that, yes, there are things that we have seen or taken pictures of or experienced on some level that are real on Earth. But to think that there's something visiting us from somewhere else, I find absolutely ridiculous. And I find it ridiculous that a scientist would really get behind anything like that because, you know, the closest star to us that could even have a planet around it, that let's say they some life form has evolved maybe a million years ahead of us, is I think the closest star is about 8 light years away. I just find it ridiculous that scientists talk about this like there's something real about it. I mean, I'm going to stick with Carl Sagan. There may be life on other planets. How evolved, we don't know. But they are not here. They've never been here. And they're probably never coming here because the size of the universe and the fact that we are so isolated, just think about just how big the Milky Way is. Not forget about the universe.
Right.
So I just don't understand.
Okay, well, let's let Kevin weigh in. Paul, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, this comes up a lot. First, Carl Sagan had done simulations of galactic colonization and found that it was possible. And the problem that Carl Sagan had with UFOs was, and he actually put it very succinctly at one point, he said, I have a hard time that somebody is coming in from interstellar space every other Tuesday.
Right.
And I do have a hard time with that as well. And from the evidence that we have so far, it really appears that they are not doing that. They're actually here. They live here. So you don't have somebody traveling through interstellar space every other Tuesday. I don't think that's the case at all. Now, can you travel from star to star is the next question. And yes, that is possible. The trick is to go fast enough. You have to, if you can get up to a large percentage of the speed of light, time slows down, relativity kicks in, time slows down for the traveler, and they can traverse great distances. A 1G acceleration, mind you, a 1G acceleration, that's the 1G of Earth's gravity,
yeah, gravity,
which is comfortable for us. If you had a spaceship accelerating at 1G, 1G acceleration is 1 light year per year per year. That means after a year, you're traveling almost the speed of light at that acceleration.
Yeah.
So if you can maintain an acceleration in space for a period of time, you can get up to pretty much any speed you want, up to the speed of light. And the closer you get to the speed of light, the slower time goes, and you can traverse those distances.
You know, to this day, I still think we're putting the cart before the horse. you are always one of those people who say, we got to go where the data takes us.
Yeah.
And so far, Carl Sagan or our caller or anybody else presupposing that we're dealing with something from distant space.
We don't actually know that yet.
It's an assumption you can't make.
Right.
We don't know what it is.
Which is why we now say that this is, we have evidence of non-human technology. Non-contemporary human technology is the phrase I prefer.
Now, what do you mean by non-contemporary? I mean, far ahead or far behind?
Well, one of the hypotheses is we could be dealing with time travelers. So they could be technology from humans from the future. There could have been a prior civilization that made some advances. So it could be technology from humans in the distant past that we don't know about.
I mean,
there's a lot of possibilities, many possibilities to worry about. We actually need to collect data to start narrowing down the number of possibilities.
All right. So tell me about how you're going to collect data. I know UAPX is quite separate from the Science Advisory Council, but UAPX basically has a go team that can go to some of these hotspots. I know you went to Catalina Island or out that way a couple of few years ago. Tell me about how your team would deploy in a hotspot.
Right. So UAPX is now it stands for University at Albany Project X. So it's a team of University at Albany scientists, and we've been studying UAP for about 8 years now, coming up on 10 years. And in fact, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be going to Connecticut. I can't disclose where that is, not to keep secrets.
Not Foxwoods.
No, not Foxwoods.
No, okay.
But because we can't have everyone and with a drone showing up to try to fool the scientists. That's a real issue. So, but we're going to a place in Connecticut where we have actually had cameras set up monitoring for since November, I think. So we've been monitoring this place for about 6 months now. We've got 6 months worth of data and imagery.
Have you found anything?
We found there's a few interesting things. We've got a lot of meteors, which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool to see the meteors come in and explode and that sort of thing. We did have a mission out there last year in May of 2025, and my colleague Matthew Shadagas spent the whole week out at the site. And there were several points where he had seen orbs that he couldn't identify, big balls of plasma. And in fact, in one case, he was able to train a telescope on one of them and said it looked like a giant ball of plasma. It was amazing.
And that's a description we hear often, especially these days.
We hear that often, yeah.
And are we dealing with a natural phenomenon here?
We don't know what the balls of plasma are, so this is one of the problems. And in fact, this is something that has come up in our Science Advisory Council. Some of the information we got from Pentagon's Arrow was that Arrow sees orbs all over the place, and they don't know what they are. Hmm. And I think that's our second purpose, working with the U.S. government to advise their. I think there are things that they haven't questions they haven't answered. You have to remember the government doesn't typically study things scientifically. A scientific study is very different than a military study, which is trying to identify, is that a Russian MiG or a Chinese balloon?
Right.
It's a very different questions. And they don't try to characterize things, which is what we do.
Interesting. Kevin Knuth is our guest. We got to go back to the phones. I did want to talk to you about the algorithms that you have worked on for image analysis and sort of separating common shapes and finding out what things in the sky are and how that comes into play in the future for Science Advisory Council work or UAPX.
Yeah, absolutely. The algorithm we use actually for UAPX is an algorithm that my colleague Matthew Shadagas wrote called CTAP. I forget what CTAP stands for, but it's a target analysis protocol. And is the TAP part. And he basically what he noticed was that to detect objects changing in the sky, changes in the sky, you compare frame to frame and you look at standard deviations of the pixels in red, green, and blue. So you look at the statistics of the pixels and you can actually identify objects this way. And that's what we use for our software. Because if you've got 24 hours of video looking at a sky, somebody has to sit down and watch that to find the objects, right?
Well, have an intern.
And that
do
is
it.
That is not that interesting. It's not that exciting. It gets boring after about 5 minutes. It's hard. So he developed the software, which basically highlights objects for us that we then can go and review.
Kevin Knuth is our guest. Let's grab a call here, and then we'll take a break and then get to the rest of the calls. Tony's in Pittsfield. Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thank you. It's a great show.
Hi, Tony.
It jogged my memory, actually, because I remembered one of my uncles when I was a kid. This is back in the 60s. He actually had worked on Project Blue Book.
Cool.
Oh, wow.
And he could never talk about it. And I used to ask him about it.
And he could never? I thought that was so unclassified. That's interesting. And he never would talk about it.
Well,
huh?
This is back. Yeah, I'd ask him
maybe back in the
60s
you couldn't.
They said, oh, he worked on Project Blue Book. And I could never get him to, and this was back when I was a kid. So maybe then it was a little more severe as far as, secrecy. But I just remembered that, and I wanted to share that with you guys. Because they couldn't talk about it. I mean, he was retired, and he still couldn't talk about it.
Well, there were classified aspects to Project Blue Book. And, so that's really interesting. Wow.
All right, Tony, thanks a lot. Let's take a quick break here, and then we'll go back and get a lot of calls in. 800-348-2551, the number. Kevin Knuth is our guest. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff with you. We're joined by Kevin Knuth from UAlbany and the UAP Science Advisory Council, as well as UAPX. And by the way, you know what? You can find a website on this new UAP Science Advisory Council and UAPX online. It's pretty easy to do. Check it out if you wish. Let's go to Charles in Lenox. Charles, you're on.
Yes. My question is related to other comments concerning the distances involved. Given the vast number of galaxies and the vast number of solar systems and planets within those galaxies, it seems highly unlikely that we're alone. There could be thousands and thousands of planets with the same chemical and thermal surroundings that we have that are conducive to life. But as someone else said, the distances involved are enormous. And your answer to that was, well, maybe they're already among us. But if they are, how did they or their ancestors get here in the first place?
Okay, good question. All right, thanks, Charles.
Yeah, no, thank you, Charles. Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I think it comes down to basically relativity again. If you travel fast enough, time slows down for you. So for example, in one of the papers I wrote on the flight characteristics of unidentified aerial vehicles, we basically work through and calculate the accelerations in these cases. So in the Nimitz case, you had a tic-tac-shaped UFO dropping from 28,000 feet to sea level in 0.78 seconds.
Yeah.
And that means that at minimum it would have had to accelerate at about 5,700 Gs to the midway point and then decelerate to stop. So you're looking at a 5,000 G acceleration, which is crazy.
Do you have the radar tracks from the Nimitz on that?
No, those don't exist.
Oh, they took them away, allegedly, didn't they?
Yeah, those got taken. So nobody knows whether they even exist or not.
That's interesting.
Yeah, So, all right, that's 5,700 Gs. In the Japanese JAL 1628 case, where you had a Japanese airliner followed by
enormous
walnut-shaped UFO that was 4 747s in length, which is the size of an aircraft carrier. We do have the radar tracks from that, and that thing is accelerating at about 10,000 Gs at points with a top speed of 250,000 miles an hour. You can get to the moon in 50 minutes. We could go to the moon now. What is it? 2:30, almost 3 o'clock. We could go to the moon, take a look around at the Falcon 9 crash site, and come back before 5 o'clock.
Yeah,
and that's fast, right? So so what could you do traveling in the galaxy at, let's say, 1,000 Gs, which is 1/5 of what we measured for the Nimitz case and 1/10 of what was measured in the JEL case. So at a 1,000 G acceleration, you can get up to 90% the speed of light in 17 hours. And at that speed, at that rate, it would take you 3 months to get across the galaxy.
Okay, let me ask you a question. We're going to go to Michael in Cummington, Mass. In just a moment. You have been following this stuff for a long time, presumably before you were ever in school or a scientist, and you have that interest. I think a lot of us, you're about the same age as I am, from that time period.
Yeah, we all watched In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Here's the thing. How do you, as a scientist, make sure you are following the data and not presupposing some of your own conceptions of what we're dealing with here?
Right. The way we do this as scientists is we focus on characterizing the situation or the object. We don't try to figure out what it is. And we leave out what it is, where it's from, forget all that. You're not going to figure that out. We try to characterize it. How fast does it go? How much energy did it expend in making those maneuvers? Those are the things I'm interested in as a physicist. And when you look at the speeds and accelerations and see these things are accelerating thousands of Gs, and you know that at a 1,000 G acceleration, you can get to 90% the speed of light in 17 hours, and that can get you across the galaxy in 3 months. Now, the tricky part, and even physicists get this mixed up, is that that's 3 months for the traveler.
Yeah.
For everybody else in the galaxy, that's an 80,000-year trip.
Right.
So, yeah, it's going to take you 80,000 years across the galaxy. Yeah, but not for the person in the spaceship. And that's a whole different ballgame.
Relativity. Let's go to Michael in Cummington, Mass. Michael, you're on with Professor Kevin Knuth.
Yeah, my question is, if we think people are, or their intelligent life visiting us, do you think what triggered them to decide to come here was when they first noticed we split the atom, or when the first atomic bomb went off? They noticed that. We got to check these people out, or whoever they are, you know.
There's a lot of speculation about that.
There's a lot of speculation about that. And the first thing to note is that these things, these objects, whatever they are, have been observed throughout human history. This goes way back. There are saucer sightings. They were called flying shields by the Romans. There's Roman sightings from 2,000 years ago.
And I've read those, but couldn't those have been meteorites? They didn't know what
meteorites
were.
In some cases, they could be. In some cases, when they describe them as flying shields, I mean, that's pretty much a flying saucer.
Right.
And the better records are actually, Richard Dolan has a book on UFOs in water.
Yep.
And underwater UFOs. And so you've got sightings from ships going back 250 years, and they're well described, and these are the same types of things that are seen today.
Yeah, all right, Michael, thanks a
lot.
They've
been here a long time.
Let's go to Zach in Olive Bridge. Zach, you're on with Professor Kevin Knuth.
Hi, thanks for having me. When I was a teenager, I was witness to what's now become a pretty famous Hudson Valley UFO sightings, and as a teenager, of course, I was freaked out by it. No sound, very odd movements of some lights in the sky, and very fast moving object. I went inside and was met with disbelief, because who is this crazy teenager to say such a thing? Did end up calling the newspaper, and the next day there were many reportings of this sighting. This was the mid-80s, and I know that they're famous group of sightings throughout the mid-80s in the Hudson Valley.
Right.
What explanations are given for that, and what possible theories are there behind those?
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, I don't think anybody knows what these things are, and then that's a tough thing to admit, but they weren't carefully studied. They weren't studied by scientists, and these are basically classed as UFO sightings. But a UFO or a UAP is a class of objects, not specific types of objects. So they're not all UAP are going to be alien spacecraft.
That's
per se.
Stanton right. Friedman always said.
Yeah, that's really true. And so we don't know what all of these objects were, and it's pretty incredible that you got to see some of them. That's amazing.
You know, the thing is, there were more than one thing going on there, Zach. I think that there was something genuinely a little out of the ordinary, or a lot out of the ordinary, but then out of Stormville, and it's documented, there were times when these ultralight pilots flew, whether they did that to just have some fun after the sightings began or whatever. But clearly, you can there are videos, and you can see the ultralights, and you can tell, you can hear them. They're ultralights, different than what a lot of people saw down there.
Well, yeah, and I couldn't hear a thing, and the speeds at which it moved and the precision, you know, it was sort of an amorphous shape, and I felt like I was pretty close, but I couldn't tell because it was massive, and it flew off very quickly and in a strange direction. And so, I know that that's been some of the explanations for it. Thanks for your response. I'll get off and let you continue.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you know, I saw him. I think I told you that, right? Over here in Albany.
Oh, yeah,
you
mentioned
80s.
That as well.
And the FAA tower was busy for about 3 hours that night.
I believe it.
It was something, man. We still don't know what it was. Although, you know, part of me says, all right, this was maybe a test of stealth fighters. I mean, it was right around that time. I can't say, oh, that was aliens. But it was something I never saw before and something I've never seen
it's,
since.
It's similar to what happened in New Jersey last year. And that was hard because some of those sightings were really interesting and really strange. And it wasn't just happening in New Jersey. It was also happening in the West Coast near Oregon and Washington, and then in, I think,
Europe.
16 other countries.
Yeah.
16 countries. So it wasn't just FAA testing drones. That might have been happening at the same time, but that was not the only thing going on.
What do you think happened with that? I mean, I think you can't make suppositions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the best hypothesis I have is that, because some of these things seem pretty unexplainable, most of them were pretty explainable. I think that you had a lot of especially in New Jersey, highly populated area. You've got all of a sudden you've got people looking up who've probably never looked up in their life, as some of us would just say, and they see an airplane or a helicopter. I got a lot of airplane and helicopter photos, and very often I go to my brother lives in Wisconsin, and he's very good at identifying airplanes. I'll send him a picture of this is supposedly one of the UFOs in New Jersey. What do you think this is? And he'll come back with me 20 minutes later. Oh, this is this kind of helicopter. And, and then I compare, and yeah, he's right. So that happened a lot, too. But it's tough.
Professor Kevin Knuth is with us from UAlbany and the UAP Science Advisory Council, headed up by Avi Loeb. And the number is 800-348-2551. We'll go to Kingston. Tom, you're on.
Hi. I was wondering if you had a best guess on what temperature these UAPs run at. I saw a video of a fighter jet pilot commenting that there is no heat trail at all from the object that was fast moving in the air. And just wanted to see what your best guess on, you know, how is there no friction involved? You know, is it a vacuum they're flying around? Like, what's your best guess?
That is an excellent, excellent, excellent question. As a scientist, this is something that we worry about. And we actually, from our UAPX group, actually has an infrared video taken by David Mason, who was one of our early members. He was just testing out his infrared cameras in his backyard, and he had two of them set up. And he captured a passenger jet coming into land at Seattle Airport. It was about 300 feet up at the time, but it was being shadowed by an unidentified object that looked like a three-leaf clover. It was really, or I joke that I think it's like a Klingon D5 warship.
So these were on FLIR camera.
This was one of the FLIR cameras, yeah. And he caught the jet was caught on one of the FLIR cameras, but the unknown object was offset a little bit and was caught on both cameras.
Are you convinced it wasn't an artifact of the camera?
No, absolutely not an artifact. Yeah. So this thing was, and it was cold. It was very cold. The jet airplane is quite hot and is all lit up in the infrared image. The cold object was about 65 degrees below zero. And in fact, I was mentioning this yesterday in our Science Advisory Council meeting with Avi Loeb. He asked me what I had thought about Go Fast, the Go Fast video that was released, and because we were talking about how it isn't actually going fast.
It looks like a drone to me.
So it isn't going fast. But I pointed out the interesting thing about that is that it's cold. If you look at the temperature scale, they don't have a temperature scale on the metadata, but it says, you know, black is hot, and BLK means black is hot. And that thing's white, so it's cold. It's cold. It's quite cold compared to the sea surface. So it's not a seagull. It's not a drone. Drones run hot.
That's
everything
amazing.
Humans make run hot. And so these things are UAP very often aren't hot, and that's an excellent question and a very strange thing about them.
Tom, thanks a lot. We'll grab another call or two here. Chris is in Freehold. Chris, you're on with Kevin Knuth.
Well, I have two things. One is, you know, just make a statement that a lot of people will preface their statements with, I believe. And when you're dealing with science, belief, should be outside the other door. But I remember as a kid reading a book called The Interrupted Journey. And what it essentially entailed was a claim by a married couple in Massachusetts that they were abducted and tested medically by aliens, I presume on their ship, if I remember correctly. And essentially, there was no time loss on their travel home. And I was wondering if you're familiar with that, and if so, are there any kind of follow-ups on an official basis regarding that?
It was New Hampshire.
Yeah, I don't know that case specifically. I'm familiar
Betty and
with
Barney
the,
Hill.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Betty and Barney Hill.
That's the one.
Oh, that's the one.
That's
the Betty
one.
And Barney
yep.
Hill. Yeah, no, that case is interesting, and there was a chemist, Phyllis Budinger, who actually analyzed Betty Hill's dress.
Yeah.
And there are stains on the dress. The dress is torn in a strange way, and there's some stains on the dress that she couldn't actually identify. So, and there's a report on the chemistry of those stains, which is interesting. But I find that that's an amazing case. And I've had people come up to me and say, oh, it's a couple who just wanted attention. And my response to that was a mixed-race couple in 1961. And no mixed-race couple wants attention in 1961. That's the exact thing you want to avoid. So it's pretty...
And ultimately, they used regressive hypnosis, and there's some question about the efficacy of that.
Yeah.
And so there are questions about this, but it's a great book. It's John Fuller. All right, very quickly, we got about a minute here with you, Kevin, this time around. You know, when this advisory council was announced, there were those who naysayed it immediately. One, Arizona State University, had some nasty things to say about Avi Loeb, and then we had... Sean Kirkpatrick, who, you know, also said some things about Avi Loeb. My question for you, as a scientist, respected scientist, you've been around the block. Are you worried about your reputation with this? Are you worried about what others think? Has the situation changed?
The situation has changed. I'm not, when I started, when I started studying these things, I was worried about my reputation, and I'm not anymore. Scientists, our job is to study things, period. Whether you like what I study or not, that's your problem, not mine. Secondly, I see this as a flight safety issue. These things are shadowing airplanes. This happens a lot. And we've heard from pilots who can't report this because they'll lose their jobs. I heard from a Delta pilot that they had a disc. So he's flying a Delta flight, 250 people in the back eating pretzels, and a disc flew up to the windscreen. They panicked and tried to dive under it, and the disc dropped down and went under the plane.
Nice.
And he could see the edge of the discs from below the plane, and it followed them for 15 minutes. And the co-pilot panicked, and fortunately they had the engineer was up there with them. The engineer and the pilot had to restrain the co-pilot from trying to get away from the UFO. He kept
Zoinks.
Trying to make maneuvers with people in the back. This is a flight safety issue.
Well,
now, this isn't public, right?
You know,
that this you might have been on this flight. There's all of a sudden turbulence. No reason.
So interesting. Well, we're out of time. Kevin Knuth, we're going to touch base again soon. I always love having you on the show. Support comes from Plaza Travel Center, presenting a small group trip from Albany to Finland's Northern Lights in February. Escorted for trip details, Gene at plazatravel.net. And WAMC On the Road, our new programming initiative bringing public radio in person throughout the WAMC listening area and face-to-face with listeners in their own communities, WAMC.org for more. And, you know, Who doesn't want to meet me face to face? Well, once you meet me, you'll know. Thanks to Kevin Canuth, thanks to Mike Bowen, Andrea Leong, and tomorrow, it's another exciting show, Gardening. We'll see you too.